Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
Lights Out by Natalie Walters. CIA analyst Bryn Taylor developed a new program to combat terrorism, and she invited members of foreign intelligence agencies to America to foster cooperation between countries. Now one of them, Egyptian spy Remen Rayad, is missing. She's forced to team up with an elite security team, the Strategic Neutralization and Protection Agency, or SNAP, to find the missing spy. The only problem? She must work with her ex-boyfriend, Jack Hudson. Jack has been working for SNAP for almost 9 years and takes the lead in hunting down the missing spy. But he never imagined he'd be working with the woman who betrayed him. Every lead they follow draws them dangerously deeper into an international plot. Kidnapping, murder, explosions, poisoning. The terrorists will do anything to accomplish their goal of causing a digital blackout that will blind a strategic U.S. military communications center and throw the world into chaos. Can Bryn surrender control to a man who doesn't trust her? And is Jack willing to risk his heart to hunt down the only person who can stop the global terrorist attack?
Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hammerker, and today I'm talking with Natalie Waters. She's the author of Carol Award finalist Living Lies, as well as Deadly Deceit and Silent Shadows. So welcome to my show, Natalie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So we were talking before we started recording about how the pandemic in 2020 was really hard on book sales. And, you know, as authors, we love our books are like second children to us. So how have you tried to, like, keep connecting with readers throughout, like, last year and then this year as well? How have you tried to help? Because books, I think, really can give us that escapism that we really needed last year, but we're probably just too tired to read. Yeah. So how have you stayed connected with your readers through all this craziness?
So I think probably one of the benefits, I know we had talked a little bit about how just, you know, our lives kind of all revolved around electronic devices and Zooms and FaceTimes and how we kind of were like, oh, this is exhausting. But at the same time, like, I think that was one of the biggest, you know, pluses to being able to stay connected to people was being able to, you know, remain on social media and be able to communicate through, you know, FaceTime and video chats and keep people updated, you know, like, this is what I'm doing. Like, this is how I'm surviving, you know, the pandemic. This is how I'm surviving isolation or time with my children or whatever the case might be. So I think that that was one of the best ways for me as an author to kind of remain connected with readers is to just, you know, stay constant on social media and, you know, ask how people are doing, what they're reading. I know, you know, when I could find the time to read or the energy to do that, I would share what books I'm reading and, you know, my favorite things about my current stories. Or, you know, I think I even did in my newsletter, I posted, what are my characters doing during COVID? And so it was kind of like, this is what my characters are doing. This is how they're surviving. So one of them decided to start cooking and the other one driving, you know, having a Marvel movie marathon and, you know, debating which character is the favorite. And so just something kind of fun to, like, remind my readers, like, hey, my characters are out there living their lives too, but in a fun way that just kind of brought some lightness to, like, the situation.
Oh, I love that. And it also helped to remind people, hey, I have books.
Yeah.
Something to, without saying, buy my book, which we all know,
right.
No one wants to be told, be marketed to all the time to share those kind of, those fun things. I mean, that's one of the reasons I started this podcast was because I wanted to, you know, just kind of help authors connect with readers in a new way and just the kind of fun little behind the scenes we can talk about. You know, what we're doing as writers and give that insight to writers and to readers. So I think that's really a fun way to connect there. And also a fun way, I think, for you as an author, right, to not have to worry. I don't have to create a story about this, but I can think about, you know, because we've already thought about whether or not they would take up cooking if they were, you know, marooned on a desert island, right?
right. Yeah. I think it was just, I always find that it's a lot easier to kind of just, you know, even as a writer, I'm sure that you understand I'm in the story with my characters also, you know, and probably mm-hmm. in a more intimate way just because I know their backgrounds and I know their likes and dislikes. And so for me, it was kind of just, it was a lot of fun to not have to really worry about, you know, the writing part of like a storyline, but just really like, okay, what would my characters be doing right now? Like, what would be, you know, what is the quirks that they have? And like, how would their, you know, their significant other be, how would they react if that was like what they had to deal with every single day? Similar to like what we were doing in real life anyhow. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. So what did your family think about your writing romantic suspense? Your bio, which people can read with this blog, says you're married to a soldier and you have three adult children. So what do they think about mom as a romantic suspense writer?
Well, it's very funny because I have differing opinions from my whole family. My husband, of course, is very supportive. He's a good resource for me being in the military and, you know, our connections to military. So there's usually some element of military in my stories, not necessarily directly associated with the plot line, but a character might have a background in the military or there might be some other element that I can bring into my story. So I'm always, you know, kind of story, like throwing things at him about the story, like, hey, do you think this would work? Is this possible? Is this correct? Is this accurate? And so that's all. So he's very supportive in that manner. My two oldest I have three kids, so my two oldest are girls, and my oldest is an avid reader. My middle daughter is kind of, she's like, okay, I'll read it, but you know, it's not like her favorite thing to do is to read stories. So but they are both very supportive. They love, like, they're, you know, it's easier, I think, like, they have no problems telling people about me as a writer, where I mm-hmm. struggle, like, going up to somebody and being like, hey, by the way, I'm a writer, you know. And so I just kind of allow them to, like, hey, we told them that you're a writer. And I'm like, oh, thanks, but it's just a lot easier. I'm like, okay, I appreciate that. My son, on the other hand, he's my youngest. So he's, my girls were a little bit older when I started writing, but he's been, like, the brunt of, like, the impact of mommy being, you know, tucked away in the office writing and, you know, cereal and PB&J sandwiches on end for dinners and absence is, you know, in the evening or whatever and seeing me stressed out. And so I remember when I wrote my first book and I submitted it and I finally came out of that writer's cave, he was like, oh, you're done. And I'm like, oh, no, I've got to start on the second one. He's like, dang it. Like, oh, man. You know, so he's so sad. So he's kind of got, like, a love-hate relationship with it. Like, he loves, you know, like, he loves me and he loves that, you know, that I have books. I know he's super proud. But he also has this, like, sort of, like, oh, that means you're going to be gone and absent and, you know, from being with him or whatever. So I try to balance that. But for the most part, you know, my family is very supportive and proud of me. And I, you know, I think that's always just really sweet.
Yeah. My kids are younger than yours and but still they've been very supportive. I have four kids, as my listeners may recall, two girls and then two boys. So, I think if I'd had three and then one had been, you know, didn't have a playmate, I might have had more, you know, pushback on that, but no, I think they're just, they've seemed pretty supportive and happy that, you know, mom has something to do.
Yeah. I think my son's kind of leaning more towards that, you know, but it's funny because, like, he'll get asked every once in a while, like, oh, what do you think of your mom writing books? And he's like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. He's like, that's cool, but, like, I don't know. So, you know, it's really strange because I think, like, on social media, especially during, like, the pandemic, it was all about, like, people with their puppies, people with their, like, cute little children, and then, like, you know, I don't know, those, like, really, like, odd Instagram people who, like, can make pictures look like magic, and I don't know how they do that, but they look good in every picture that they post, and they know how to work the camera or whatever. But for me, I'm like, I don't have a dog, and my kids are like angsty teenagers or 20-something-year-olds who really don't want me to be posting pictures of them. So it's not cute. And I'm like, and I don't know how to operate my iPhone camera very well. So what you get on social media is me awkward in real life, trying my best, you know, and every once in a while, like, having my children pop in to just be even more awkward.
Right. Yeah. No, we tend to not post really any pictures. I don't think we've ever posted a picture of our kids on social media. Yeah. We just decided, not to. My girls have Instagram, or I think they have Instagram accounts and probably TikTok accounts. I don't know. They follow people and stuff. I'm like, yeah, you know the rules. We talked about all this. You're good.
Right.
But I just don't post. We just decided that they can create their own digital footprint, and we're just going to leave that to them.
No, I think that's really smart. I think, obviously being connected to the military, we have always been very conditioned to watch for, we call it OPSEC, so operational security, and like what I post on there. So for the most part, like, my husband has, like, I guess, like, he's got a code name. Like, I don't post his name. Anybody who knows how to operate a computer would easily be able to find out information that they, want.
Right.
So I the same as you. Like, I have, pictures of, like, when my family's been together and my kids are in the pictures. But, like, there's no names, and I'm always careful that people don't tag. And I've had to tell my children that, too. Like, hey, because my son, I did post something with him in it, and I covered his name, on the thing. And he's like, why did you cover my name? And I was like, because people don't need to know your name. Like, they don't need to be, knowing who you are or whatever. Not that I'm any kind of special person, but just, I write romantic suspense, so I know there's weirdos out there.
I
write about them in my stories.
I don't
want to invite that door.
Yeah, that's exactly why. And I know some of my friends are like, well, why have this security? I said, look, this is not, you don't have to do this. You can post whatever you want to post. I am just my brain just goes way too, I don't want to make it easy for anyone to find a kid. And I know that we were also the parents who told the schools, look, you're not using my kids on your social media, accounts.
Yeah.
You're not leaving. You might not post pictures of them, but you're not going to use them like that. And they were all very understanding, very supportive, because we just feel like it's not our story to tell, for one thing, their story. And I write romantic suspense. And my husband's cautious, too. And we're like, yeah, I think we'll just, err on the way on the other side. Because I was like, yeah, I don't want to get easy on people. And they can tell their own thing. But most of the time.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things, like, with suspense writers. Our mind is always, like, because we're writing suspense, so we have to be in the bad guy's mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't know for you, but, like, for me, like, I'm researching and I'm watching these, I'm watching the news, or I'm reading a book, or I'm doing something, and you realize, like, oh, there's a lot of, like, really bad stuff out in the world. And so when you think about those things, my mind is constantly thinking, like, okay, when I'm on the phone with my daughters and they're like, oh, mom, somebody's at the door, hold on. And I literally, my first thought is, I'm going to witness by the phone somebody attacking my child, because, like, they put me on hold. And so the phone's set down, and I just, like, that's where my mind naturally goes to. And it's like, oh, it was, like, the Amazon guy, or, oh, it was the neighbor selling Girl Scout cookies. And I'm like, okay, but that's not where my mind went. So I think we're naturally prone to, like, those fearful, like, okay, this is what could happen, because we live in that with our fiction, and it's also real life too. So
yeah, and it's hard to keep that balance. I think, we're big proponents on letting our children, go and do things as soon as they're capable. Like, we let them walk to our public library through our neighborhood, perfectly safe. It's like maybe a mile from our house. And they thought that was great, but there was this one little path that goes through this wooded area, and we said, you just can't take that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, don't take it. It wasn't exactly a shortcut. I mean, they could take it, but we're like, just stay on the sidewalks
right,
by
don't.
The street. Yeah. And they're, you know, so, yeah, because I'm like, that path is like it's not long, but it's just, it would be like a perfect, like, somebody waiting to do something.
Right.
Kind of a path.
Exactly. Because that's what we would put in our book, because if we were writing that, you know, we were writing the scene, that's where the scene would take place. And I think that that's where we're always thinking of, you know, I walked through Central Park with my family, and I was like, oh, I totally know how you could hide a body in Central Park, like how you could get it through here, because there's so many people, but nobody's paying attention to anybody. And like, there's these travelers just like pulling luggage through Central Park to like their hotel or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, who is to say like what's inside their suitcase? And they just leave it and then they keep walking and nobody would be the wiser. But yeah,
I know.
But kids don't really appreciate all of like my, you know, kind of morbid thought process, but it helps me write stories. So, you know, I can't, they can't bag on it too much.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I know. I get the mom, really? Because sometimes I'll hear a news article and thinking, huh, I wonder what would happen if they're like, mom, stop plotting out loud.
Right. Stop.
Keep that to yourself. I know. But it is super fun. And, you know, but it's hard to explain to non-writers, you know, readers or someone who asks. And I'm like, I try not to go down the rabbit hole too far.
Yeah.
Although when I meet someone who has a really neat career, like someone in our church is a 911 call taker. And I'm like, man, I am going to be, because I had an idea even before I realized that's what she did. For that to be, I think my hero was going to do it while he was on disability for something. And I thought, I need to talk. I said, I'm going to be calling you.
Yeah.
Do you mind? Because this is, like, great.
Yeah,
I can get it.
Absolutely.
I can get it right. I know it differs from locality, but I can get a general sense of, you know, what they do, how they take it and stuff. So I'm super excited about that.
Yeah. No, I had a moment like that. I started my new series that's coming out. I have one of my characters was in the military, and he is an EOD specialist. So an explosive ordnance. That's what he deals with is bombs and that kind of a thing. And so I was asking my husband, I was like, I need somebody to like, give me some information because I need to know which wires to cut and which wires to stay away from and that kind of stuff. And so we just PCS. So we just moved from our assignment in Hawaii, and at our farewell, my husband introduced me to an EOD officer, and he actually connected me to his trainer who has more experience in it. But it was the same thing. I was like, yes, like this is who I need to talk to, because I need to know like those little details that are just going to add that level of authenticity to the story, but they create these great characters and they create great tension for the storyline. So everybody,
yeah.
I don't think people realize like you're in danger if you know a writer, because we will use anything and everything if it suits our story.
Yes. That's so true. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today, Natalie. So thank you so much for being on my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
You have been listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hammerker, and I've been talking with Natalie Waters. She's the author of Living Lies, Deadly Deceit, and Silent Shadows. And stay tuned for an excerpt from her latest, Lights Out.
Now an excerpt from Lights Out by Natalie Waters. Ma'adi, suburb of Cairo, Egypt, 3:17 p.m., Tuesday, January 13th. Saif al-Dib watched the noisy trio of American boys cross the street away from Cairo American College. The international school had just let out for the afternoon, and the sound of privileged children laughing about their day mingled with the horns of waiting drivers and taxis trying to navigate the afternoon congestion.
Saif, you will send your child to this school?
The old man behind the wooden counter of the kiosk laughed at his own question, causing the cigarette at his lips to bounce. Saif ignored the vendor as the man continued chuckling while he straightened the rows of chips and snacks. Toying with the metal band around his finger, Saif shook his head, mostly to himself. The vendor already knew the answer, which was why he was laughing. CAC was a private school with a tuition rate only the wealthiest Egyptians could afford, and foreigners, especially Americans, or the grandchildren of the former president. Saif eyed the 12-foot cement wall surrounding the school. Iron paling embedded at the top gave the impression of a fortress, as did the private security officers positioned at the front and rear entrances to monitor every student, parent, and visitor entering or leaving. Their presence had doubled since the protests against President Talat began more than a year ago, a promise by both the school and the president that these children would be kept safe at all costs. A fortress of education and protection Saif's son or daughter would never know. Lighting his own cigarette, Saif stepped aside as the three American boys walked up to the street kiosk and purchased candy. One of them, a blonde, set the Egyptian bill on the worn and splintered counter just as a breeze came through, lifting the money into the air. The boys laughed as the old man scrambled for it, none of them helping as they took their candy and walked away. Saif hurried, following the money as it floated in the air over the busy intersection. Ignoring the blaring horns and shouts, he stepped into the street and caught the bill before it flew farther away.
Shukran,
the vendor thanked him before tucking the money into a box.
These kids do not know how fortunate they are. Allah has blessed them, and they forget it can be taken away.
Taking a long drag from his cigarette, Saif continued to watch the boys make their way to a large white Toyota Sequoia. The heavy thunk of the door closing after they crawled in told Saif the vehicle was weighed down with armor.
Allah has blessed them.
What about him, or his wife Hiba, or his child she was currently carrying? Where was Allah's blessing for them? He'd been good, memorized the tenets of the Quran, fasted for Ramadan, never missed a call to prayer, and yet here he was working two jobs just to provide for his family. A business card burned inside his pocket. Fishing it out, he rolled the curled edges back and studied it. Mahmoud Farag, 20010-1251-175. Just a name and a number. The card left on the seat of his work van 3 weeks ago. Saif assumed it was job-related, someone wanting sabato, a favor, street deal. As a technician for Nile Telecom, Saif had discovered that while he did not possess the kind of education protected by a fortified wall, he possessed a job that gave him favor. Those sabatos were what kept Hiba happy, safe, and out of the squalor he grew up in. He dropped the finished cigarette to the ground and smashed it with the toe of his shoe.
Masalama. Inshallah,
the old man responded. God willing. Yes, that was the hope. But the funny thing about hope was that it seemed to be selective, blessing those with the wealth to afford it, the power to control it, or the will to fight for it. Saif's mobile rang. The number matched that on the card. Did he have the will to fight for it? For himself, he'd grown up suffering. For Hiba, she was not his first choice when it came to their arrangement, but he was slowly coming to love her. But for his child, the ever-present ache in his chest pulsed. For his child, he'd do whatever it took. Spitting the taste of tobacco from his mouth, Saif answered,
Al-Salamu alaikum. Wa alaikum al-Salam,
the male voice responded to the greeting.
White car to your left, pink dice in the mirror.
Get in and say nothing.
The Arabic came out low and raspy, and Saif had to press his mobile phone to his ear to hear over the din of the growing traffic around him.
White car? White car on your left. Pink dice. Say nothing.
The clipped response sent a chill across Saif's shoulders, despite the rare 21-degree temps keeping the city balmy this early in the year. Searching to his left, Saif panicked. There were nearly a dozen white cars parked or moving in and around the school's barriers. Shading his eyes, he searched for pink dice, but the glare of the sun was too much, forcing him to cross into the chaotic traffic. A black car screeched to a halt, nearly clipping him, and the driver stuck his head out of the car, cursing. Saif pressed the fingers of his right hand together, a gesture asking for the impatient driver to wait. The irate man inched forward, horn honking until Saif moved far enough over that he could steer around him, leaving a string of curses in his wake.
"You have 1 minute,"
the voice said.
"Wait, please!"
Saif moved quicker, eyes scanning every car for pink dice. His heart pounded in his chest with each passing second, a ticking time bomb threatening to erase the hope he had allowed to enter his heart.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.